So we're starting the second half of the program. And there's actually a very nice discussion or description at the beginning of the chapter from When It Rains. It explains what we're going to be doing through the rest of the program, basically. And it's very different from what you might expect, it seems to me, because, you know, we spent the last 3 months going through space, time, and knowledge a second time and really deepening our understanding. And to some extent, although I'm not ever completely happy with saying this, but to some extent you could think of that as being, you know, working with the second level of space and time and knowledge. Natural move, you'd think, would be to go through them again, and this time we're doing the third level, right? But that's not what we're doing. And that's not what is laid out in those first, in that first paragraph of From When It Rains. What we're doing is we're going back to ordinary experience and looking at it, you could say, all over again. And of course, one way you can see that is, it's very obvious, is that we're starting at the beginning of one of the books. You know, it's not like we're going into the later part of a book where it's going into, I don't know, some sort of more subtle approach. We're starting at the beginning. But the reason we're doing that now, it seems to me, is that now we have a way of questioning our ordinary understanding. And so we go back to our ordinary understanding, and in light of what we've been exploring in the first year, the first half of the program, we now look again, or we take a kind of a very coherent view, because we're going to be spending this whole session and the session after that, that is to say the next 12 weeks, we're going to be working our way through one of the books, Knowledge of Time and Space, and its approach to time. So it's an interesting way of investigating now, saying, well, let's start with something very normal, ordinary, the three times. That's what the section that we read for today is called. Remember, in Knowledge of Time and Space, there's always a little header for groups of two or three or four chapters at a time. And this section, this header, is about the three times. So we're starting with three times. And, you know, if you ask someone about time, you said, tell me everything you know about time, they might not have much to say. But one thing they might very well say is that time is divided up into past, present, and future. And so that's our starting point, just the three times, past, present, and future. And so what we're going to be doing in certainly today, and as we begin to go further into knowledge of time and space, this will still, I think, be part of what we're doing. We're just going to try to make more problematic, you could say, or to raise questions about our ordinary understanding. We're not exactly saying that understanding is wrong, but we want to make clear that it is just an understanding, one way of making sense of time in this case, because that's our focus. And as we question it, we begin to learn something through the act of questioning, which of course is the basic approach in TSK. That's important enough that I really wanted to emphasize it at the beginning. In Sacred Dimensions, which is where the exercise comes from for this week, which is not a specific exercise, I mean, it's not labeled as such, but it's part of the reading on time from Sacred Dimensions. And we're going to do that exercise in just a couple of minutes, or at least part of the exercise, in keeping with the approach we've been using of really starting with an exercise. But I wanted to call your attention to a very nice, clear, simple statement at the top of page 84 of Sacred Dimensions, which talks about why we're doing this or what the value is. He says, actively inquiring into the structure of time. So this is the past, present, future structure. Actively inquiring into the structure of time, either by focusing directly on the disappearing present or on how memory images are different from other images, and that's the practice that we're going to look at. But in either case, actively inquiring into the structure of time may allow us to draw closer to time itself. The act of investigating, the framing of a precise question, exercises knowledge. It begins almost immediately to strengthen the natural intelligence of the mind, to stimulate its curiosity and interest. As one question leads to the next, new avenues of inquiry open spontaneously. There is a growing sense of penetrating into the subject of inquiry. Time begins to disclose its workings to knowledge. So that's the basic approach we're taking. And as I say, I think it's actually a really nice description of the methodology, you could say, of TSK in general. Pretty remarkable, actually. That's what we want to do, and it's what we're going to do. It's as always in TSK, it's an experiential inquiry, right? And so we start. So let me say something about that. It's experiential, but it's not necessarily experiential in the sense that you're trying to evoke a new experience. There are practices in TSK, as you all know, which are like that, which say, if you engage experience in this way, some new possibilities, new kinds of experiences may arise. But the kind of experiential inquiry we're doing here is a questioning kind of inquiry. It's just making something questionable that ordinarily we don't think about. And that's basically what the exercises from Sacred Dimensions are doing. Now, when it rains, let me take a look at the exact passage. On page 95 at the top, when it's talking about how to work with the chapters from KTS, Knowledge of Time and Space, it says, experientially, the aim at the outset is to contact time directly. And again, it's not that we're going to be doing some special exercise that kind of puts us in touch with something new, which is time experienced directly. It's rather that by asking the question, within our ordinary experience of time, we begin to understand something about the timing of time or the timeness of time, or to go a little closer to what we usually understand, the dynamic of time. That's really what we want to be doing. And in doing that, we're not moving away from ordinary experience, but we're opening it up so that we see more. So, if you think about space and suppose you said, we want to contact space directly. And we've looked at this a lot in the past. In a way, you can't contact space directly because there's nothing there. What you have to contact, that is to say, you can't say, there's this object space that I want to contact, because the very nature of space is that it's not an object. It's an allowing dimension within all experience. And the same thing is true of time. It's the dynamic dimension, you could say, something like that. Just saying that doesn't tell us enough. That's why we need to go into it, why we need to ask questions. But the word dynamic does seem to be really important for understanding something about time. So it's the dynamic dimension, and we want to be able to investigate and understand something about that dynamic, about that timing. So we want to do a practice. to start us off. And it's the practice that was assigned here for this first week, which is, it actually has several parts to it. We're just going to look at the first part. And it's from Sacred Dimensions, and it's on page 82 and 83, I guess. And it has to do with what makes a memory, or with the feel of a memory. So let's take a look at it, take a little while to clarify it, and then we'll do it for a few minutes and see what happens. Okay, so he's been talking about memory in the section before what we're looking at. And maybe just for a moment, look back at the bottom of page 81, if you have the book. If you don't, I'm about to do that. At the bottom of page 81, he asks, how do we make distinctions between the past, the present, and the future? Exactly how does the mind perceive the past, or does it even perceive the past? And then he starts to look into the past. And this whole section in the book is called Investigating the Past. And he asks, can we look into the pastness of time in a more direct way? And that's what this exercise sets out to do. The exercise is pretty straightforward. It says, here this is in the section, the next section in the book. It's the middle of page 82. And the question that's asked is, how is the feel of a memory created around an image? Now, the idea of around here is something we can talk about for a moment. But how is the feel of a memory created around an image so that we can distinguish it from a similar image in our imagination? And then he asks a second question, which we're not going to look at so much. Where did that former present go? So let's make sure we're clear about this. And I'm sure you've worked with it already, but let's make sure we're clear about it. So an image comes into our minds. Now, there are various possibilities. One is that we could be anticipating something, you know, something that's going to, we know, we expect is going to happen in the future, and we just imagine what it's going to look like, but it's future imagination. Another is that we just imagine something. We don't expect that it's going to happen. And maybe, in fact, it's kind of fantastic. Or maybe it's not. But in any case, we don't assign it to the future. We just, I guess, assign it to the realm of imagination. And then the third possibility is that we have a memory. So we have an image, and we assign it to the past. And I think when we're talking about the past here, we're really talking about our past. That is something that we actually experienced. So, in other words, if you say, reflect back on the age of dinosaurs, and so then some image comes into your mind with dinosaurs roaming the earth, you know, that's just imagination. It's not a memory. And the word memory pretty much says that. You know, I don't remember the age of dinosaurs, even though I'm convinced that it happened in the past. So memory has to do with our own personal memory, what it is that we ourselves can look back on and say, yes, that happened to me, or maybe, yes, I saw that happen. That's what a memory is about. And so the question here is, how do we know that that's a memory? In other words, you know, it's hard to say these things in the right way, but the image comes up and we know that it's a memory image. We say, yeah, that happened to me in the past. And the question is, what is the feel of that, right? So there's some suggestions that are mentioned here at the bottom of page 82. The pastness of time is the goneness of the present, or the finishedness of the moment. Those are just other ways of talking about what makes a memory what gives it the specific flavor of being in the past, right? You say, well, that already happened. It's done. It's finished. It's gone. So that's a kind of marker that we give it. But the question is, what is the actual feel? You know? So suppose, this would be kind of funny, but I guess you could do it. So suppose you wrote down a list of 10 events, and 5 of them had actually happened to you in the past, and 5 were things that you either imagined or thought would happen in the present. And so then you looked at each of those 10 events, and you tried to understand, or as you looked at them, you looked to say, what makes the past events the past? You know, you say, well, I just know they're past, right? And that's okay. That's kind of an answer. But what's being suggested here, I think, is that's just kind of, that's the conclusion we draw. But the question that's being asked is there a specific feel to a past event that lets you identify it as the past? So one thing you might do, again, we aren't going to do this now, but as it said in the passage I read from page 84, once you ask one question, other kinds of questions, other possible questions arise. So another thing you might try to do is to take something you know is in the past and really try to tell yourself that it's in the future. Because after all, in some ways, the differences are not great. Suppose I had breakfast this morning, and that was in the past, and I can remember it. But I look ahead, and I say, well, tomorrow I'm going to have the same thing for breakfast. So now I'm going to imagine having breakfast in the future. Well, I probably will imagine pretty much the same as what I remember. It'll just be a repeat. But in one case, I've assigned it the label, this was in the past, and in the other case, I've assigned it the label, this is going to take place in the future. What we're asking for is what's the difference? What's the distinction between the two? So that would be one way to approach that question, is through that particular exercise. I'm not necessarily suggesting that we do it that way, but you could look at it that way. There are certainly other ways you could explore. Some of you may be familiar with the exercise from the TSK book, which is called A Stream of Memories. I'm not going to try to describe that right now, but that would be another way to really explore what it means to remember something. And then there's another question that's brought up here. You know, you say, okay, well, I just know that it's in the past. And I've already said, if that's what you say, you're leaving out the possibility of really getting the feel of something being in the past. So the book, as a way of I think helping us see that it's not quite enough to say that it's in the past, says, well, what about an ordering of memories? This is the very bottom of page 82. In other words, if you remember, you say, what was happening when I first woke up this morning, and then what was happening when I had breakfast, let's say, and then what was happening after lunch, for those of you who've already had lunch, given your time zone, in any event, at different times during the day, not only do we remember or do we have a sense of things being in the past, but we have a sense of them being ordered in the past. You know, this one happened before that one or after that one. And it's kind of surprising that we can do that. And again, is there a feel to that, or is there kind of a, it's like we have an ongoing calendar of events kind of that we can always consult and say, no, that one really happened before this one. We seem to know it, mostly. I mean, sometimes we're not sure. But mostly we seem to know this event happened before that event. And we don't so much get confused about it. So that's another question. But for now, the question that we're asking is really the one that's at the very bottom of page 82. When we look at a series of memories, can we find the common feel in all the images? I'm quoting there. Can we feel their differences? So, okay, so they're all memories. They all feel like memories, maybe. But there is something that sets them apart. For instance, one is further back in time. So this is the whole range of questions, and we're just trying to open it up for questioning, you know, to make it, you know, in English we say problematize it. But that's not such a good term, because it's not like it's supposed to be a problem. It's just supposed to be something that we get to ask about now that we don't usually think to ask about. Anyway, I've been talking around about this for a while. Let me raise one more possibility that you could look at if you do this practice, and then we'll do it for a few minutes. The possibility is that you would say, well, I know it's a memory because I don't have the sense that I'm present, right? So here we are right now, this conversation, which so far has been a monologue, this conversation is ongoing, and there's a sense of, you know, I'm really here. This is what's happening right now. Whereas if you think back to what was going on a few minutes before the phone conversation started, it's like I'm here and I'm looking back at the past. And so the past is where I'm not. That doesn't, of course, address the question of the difference between the past and the future, because the same thing would be true for the future. But, you know, you could come up with various criteria. This is an interesting one to look at, and the reason I wanted to point it out now is because perhaps as you look at memory and look at specific memories, you could be asking about this question of the pastness of the presence of the self. Is that what distinguishes this? What is it? We just want to ask. You know, we're just kind of exploring, and of course, we're not trying to come up with a theory or an explanation. We want to see what is the feel of the pastness of a past event, or the feel of something being a memory. So I think I've talked about it enough. If there aren't any questions, let's go ahead and try it for a few minutes, okay? We'll do it for about 4 or 5 minutes. Okay. So I open it up for your observations, your thoughts, your comments. And we have something already. Okay, David. So David writes, actually, David, you sent this privately. Maybe you could send it again publicly so that other people can see it. But I will go ahead and read it now. David writes, I remember sitting on the beach. The memory images include the feel of the heat of the sun on my skin, the bright blueness of the sky, and the blue-green ocean crashing waves, the salt smell, the sound of all the people laughing, talking all around us. So it was all these sensory things you're reporting here. So referring to the feelings associated with that memory are the content of that memory, of that experience. The memory is an accounting of the sense impressions that are recalled. And that was possible because of the presence of having been there. Okay, well, that's good. That's very interesting. I don't know that you have to limit it to sense impressions, because surely sometimes you have other kinds of memories that focus more on feelings, or perhaps focus on the, well, for instance, the content of what you see. Let's say you remember seeing somebody on the street. I mean, you could say that's a sense impression, but yours were so focused on the body. Okay, so but I think that the connection that you make here between feelings and memories seems really good. I will share something that I was just looking at. It seems as though when you have a memory of something, there is the sense of what you were feeling in that moment. So perhaps your senses, what you were sensing in that moment, or perhaps on the level of feeling, sort of the general feel of the situation, for instance, as one possibility. The fact that you sort of re-feel the feel, that's kind of what I would say. You kind of re-feel the feel of what you're saying, of feeling. That re-feel, that present re-feeling is a kind of guarantor that what you're looking at is the present, or sorry, is the past. Although you might be able to do that for the future too. It's worth looking. I don't know. Okay. Caroline says, I don't feel not present in the past. Rather, it's a sort of like a sort of Russian doll structure of past feelings simultaneously encased within these present feelings. That's somewhat related or similar to what I was saying, I think. I noticed the further back in time the memory, the more indistinct the sensory details become, more hazy or fuzzy. That seems right, although I don't think it holds completely, because you know, there are certain memories that are very vivid, right? And they may have happened a long time ago, and they're more vivid than something that happened, let's say, a few minutes ago. But if you're just kind of taking a sequence of memories that don't have any special significance for you, then it does seem true that it's easier to bring back in the specific sensory content of each memory. Right? Okay, let's go on. Still looking at what Caroline wrote. I notice, let's see, the strongest impressions are visual, with hearing being the least clear. That's interesting. The strongest impressions are visual, with hearing being the least clear. Maybe somebody else would like to comment on that. You know, there are some things that are just, you know, different people have different experiences. Maybe for other people, other aspects would be more clear. So it's just worth looking at. So David did repost his description publicly, so everybody has it there. Klaus writes, "The past appears to me on the right side and feels more relaxed, since nothing can be done about it anymore." Yes, the future appears on the left side and is more connected with a sense of excitement. What do I have to do? Interesting. So that's actually very, just the opposite of how we usually think about past and future, isn't it? I think in our culture, most people seem to think about the past as being on the left and the future on the right. But you're saying it's just the opposite. So it'd be interesting to hear more about what that means for you, to have it appear on the left or right. So is there an image of the past, and it's in the left part of your visual, or rather the right part of your visual field? That sounds like what you're saying, and I don't know for sure if that's what you mean. Again, you know, there might be situations, it's easy to imagine situations where you might test that, because you say the past feels more relaxed because there's nothing to be done about it. But, you know, there are some past events which have a very strong emotional charge and maybe attention, so something you regret. Now, that goes back to the question of, you know, what is the link between our present reaction or our present engagement with a memory and the memory itself? So if I think back to something and I feel regret, let's say, you'd say, well, the regret is my present reaction. The memory itself is kind of neutral. But is that the right way to think about it? I'm not sure. You know, maybe the regret is inseparable from the past memory, in which case it starts to suggest that this distinction, this way we have of dividing up past and present and future, you know, is accurate for some purposes, but maybe not accurate for others. And that, of course, is just an example of how it is that when we start to question our experience, new possibilities, new ways of integrating, new patterns or structures start to suggest themselves. Okay, Sudhi says, "It seems that the present can have a higher level of cognitive fusion. I am more lost in the content of what is happening." Well, that's interesting. So when I first read that, when I saw the words cognitive fusion, I thought, well, what does that mean? But by the time I finished what you wrote, I think I have a clear sense of what you mean. You're saying, if I understand, that in the present, the tendency is to lose ourselves in the present. You know, the present is our reality, and we very much connect the sense of reality with being in the present, which is one of the topics that we're going to be exploring in these weeks. Whereas the past, if I look back at the past, I'm distanced from it. There isn't fusion. Right? So it's, here I am having a memory. Now, again, there may be exceptions. It seems I think I'm drawing mostly on works of fiction here, not so much my experience. Well, I'm not sure. Sometimes, it seems like sometimes you really do get completely involved in something that happened in the past, almost as though you were reliving it. But still, I understand the distinction, and it's really interesting and worth exploring. Right? In the past, we're not so lost in the content. Eliana writes, "The memories are like reference points, points that are closed objectively." Okay, so in other words, they've already happened, as Klaus said. So in terms of our usual objective time, past, present, future, points in the past are closed. So points that are closed objectively but can be opened subjectively. Objectively, a glass is broken, but subjectively, I can feel sorry or not. Yeah, that's very much along the lines of some of the questions that we've started to explore here. You know, if subjectively I have a reaction to a memory. Is that part of the memory, or is the memory kind of, what can we say, in the distance? You know, there's no cognitive fusion, but then I have my present reaction to it. Or do you want to say it the other way around and say the reaction is really part of the memory? So, you know, let's imagine you had a fight with somebody and you are unhappy about it or you regret it. And for days, let's say it happened fairly recently, and so for days, every time you think about that, there's that quality of regret. Well, is that part of the memory? And then let's suppose you meet with that person and it all gets resolved and you feel okay. But now you think back on that event, that objective event, and it no longer has the feeling of regret. Is it still the same memory with a different present reaction? Or is the memory itself now different because the reaction has actually been part of it all along? Those are questions. We don't have to answer them. Okay. Robert writes, "The present has a feeling of aliveness that is immediate and directly accessible, allowing me to act and bring about change. While memories seem less alive and accessibility has to be worked on, I think, and is not open to change in the same way." Yeah, this is kind of, it's another dimension of this quality of fusion. Sudhi talked about cognitive fusion, but it's more like an engagement you're talking about. Okay, and Sudhi, I guess, corrects her statement a little. Says she's still talking about cognitive fusion. She says in the past memories, that cognitive fusion is less. Yeah, so it might be there, but most often it's going to be less. Okay. And John says, the images that are memories contain a residual presence. I can distinguish them because I was present with them at one time. Whereas the future image, okay, so John, you're making the distinction here, and in some ways, it's very good to bring that in. You know, between the past and the present, you can say, well, the present's more immediate, more alive, or there's more cognitive fusion. There's many ways you can distinguish that. But what about the difference between the past and the future? We haven't really been looking at that, although I mentioned it before. Okay, so you say, whereas the future image has not yet had my presence with it, somehow my presence imprints as it passes. Well, that's an interesting way of saying it. I'll leave that without any comment. But actually, though, it reminds me of something. I think I heard you mention an image that I've found helpful in the that has to do with memories, and that is that there's a very nice word. Some of you have heard me talk about this. There's a very interesting word in English. I looked up the origins once, and when I did, I found it was really a nice, useful idea. The word in English is aftermath. And so we usually say something happens and then there's an aftermath. Something happens as a result of that later. That's roughly our sense of aftermath. When you actually look at the meaning of the word math in some older meaning means harvest. And so what happens is you harvest a field of crops, and then after you've harvested it, there's still some further growth, and that's the aftermath. And so it's a really nice image, and I think it suggests something like what John is saying here too, that you know, there's something that happened in the past, and there was your reaction and engagement with it, and then it's still available. There's sort of an aftermath. And because that aftermath is available, that's how you know it's the past. Whereas in the future, that aftermath is not there. But you know, as I say that, it leads me back to something that the various comments people have been making, which I think are really helpful. Those various comments are suggesting something, which is that you know, it's harder than we initially think to separate out the past and the present and the future, because, you know, when there's a past memory, there's, you could say, a present reaction to it. I raised the question, is that part of the past memory? But in any event, the two somehow are really closely connected with each other. And then in the, you know, if we think about the future, and there's that quality of anticipation, let's say, but there may also be a specific emotion that comes with it. Probably because of the issue of cognitive fusion and also, I don't have a word for it, but Robert mentioned about the action possibilities that are there in the future. Or you could say the sensory fusion, which David talked about. The future doesn't seem to have any of those qualities. And yet, you know, sometimes we have very vivid daydreams about the future. So, okay, I think in a sense, you know, we're exploring these different possibilities, and it's got a little bit of a chaotic is too strong, but kind of a disorderly quality to it. And it's partly, I think, because these things, when you look at them, you realize that the initial separations and distinctions that we make are not as neat and clean as we think. So we find ourselves kind of stumbling a little bit and say, well, that's the past. Yeah, but wait a minute, that's sort of like the present, or that's the future, and that's kind of like the past, or you know, the past has a present dimension to it, or vice versa. So these are some of the things that we're beginning to look at, and I think the beginning quality is just fine. It's plenty. There's a couple more comments, so this is going to carry us to the end of this session. It's great. People have a lot to say. So Michael said, memories felt more like snapshots than a flowing unfolding. That's interesting. The impulse to find coherence seemed to require a system or organization, such as the before and after of linear time. The evidence of content more than the arriving of a flowing presence. Okay. So intuitively, that makes a lot of sense. A memory comes up and it's kind of cut off, you know, in the sense that we remember something specific. Now, it might be that we remember a sequence, right? But so in other words, let's say you remember a conversation you had with somebody. And, well, it's interesting. Do you remember it one moment at a time? You know, do you remember it in kind of as though it were in real time playing out before you? Or is the whole of the conversation present for you all at once, even though it encompasses a sequence in time? That's an interesting question. It's easy for me. I just get to say, oh, very interesting question. I don't have to... I don't have to say, yeah, that's the way it is. No, they really are just interesting questions and things that are good to look at. But definitely the distinction that you're making here between a kind of a snapshot, as you say, and actually that term gets used in sacred dimensions, between a snapshot in the past and the flowing presence, right? But that then begins with the flowing presence of presence, of the present, let's say. But now there's an interesting distinction that comes up, because there's the presence, you know, a memory shows up in the present, right? It's part of the flowing presence. And yet the content of the memory is very clearly labeled, you know, past, past, past. It's like, I noticed that in Europe, it was just in Europe, last month, and I noticed that they don't do this so much in Europe, but in America, most construction equipment, you know, the heavy machinery they use, and some cars too, when you back up, it beeps, right? So to alert people so that you don't, you know, get run over. And you could say the past is sort of like that, you know, maybe the future is like that. When it shows up in the flowing stream of the present, it's got this little beep, 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 you know, which is the past. You know, so you remember, you're sure that it's the past. Of course, we do that automatically, like it's so simple. We don't need to worry about it. We know that it's in the past. And if we didn't, if we were confused about whether it was actually happening now or in the past, we'd be in trouble. Nonetheless, there is some marker, and maybe that whole model, that's kind of the model we started out with. What's the marker of the past? Maybe that whole model needs to be reexamined. Okay, let's see. Ken says, and okay, but I want to finish up now, we're out of time. But Ken says, the memory image or story is not open, it's done, with a feeling of familiarity. Yeah, that's interesting. Familiarity. Of course, sometimes it happens that you remember something that's new, that you hadn't remembered before. But it still, I suppose, feels familiar. I mean, maybe the word familiarity is just a kind of an ownership. Like, yes, that happened to me. Right? Now, it does happen that people remember things that never actually happened. Right? Or they remember something as having happened to me that in fact happened to somebody else. There are studies in psychology about that and anecdotes, and you know, I can't reference that right now, but I think it's common that that's the case. Nonetheless, maybe that's just a misplaced familiarity marker, right? There's a feeling of familiarity, but in fact, the memory doesn't deserve it. We're tricked. Okay, Ken says, well said, but I assume he's not commenting on his own comment. I'm sorry, it was Karen who said that. So he is commenting on that. It seems like I skipped a few. Let's see. Okay, past familiarity. Yeah, I see. I did. I skipped a few. Let's move through quickly. Okay, Karen is the one who said there's that feeling of familiarity, not Ken. And Ken said that was well said. Okay. I'm just going to read these so that we have a complete record and also for people who aren't logged on and can't see the chat box. So David says, Jack, I think you're right about feelings not being the only part of the memory or the only content, though I suppose recalling a memory could be thought of as all content. Yeah, that's an interesting question, which I will not try to deal with. But I'm recalling space in the memory, too, or at least blanks or gaps in the content where perhaps there was a lapse in my attention at the time. Yeah, okay, so a lot of interesting questions there. When we remember something, you know, how accurate is the memory? Do we also remember the places where we sort of blank out? This is what you're suggesting. Do we remember the field of the memory? You say here space, but I'm going to amend that to say field. Those are all great questions. And let's see. Klaus says, asking these questions, it becomes very clear that all of that can only happen by some kind of positioning. Yeah, great point. Without the self as an act of positioning, neither the past nor the present nor the future would appear. This raises the very interesting question of the relationship of the self in the present moment as being the determinant of what's past and future. I think I'll say something about that in the transition, which I will write after this. There's a lot, of course, you know, we haven't really talked about the reading at all for this week, so I'll say some things about that. In the transition and orientation, but I think the discussion here has been great, so I'm very happy with it. Sudhi will give the last word. It's interesting that in the case of past trauma of soldiers in war, the past fusion is so strong that they go through the same past experience. Yes, a very good counterexample, right? People have flashbacks, and it seems as though it's real. And that's kind of, you could say, I guess, the exception that proves the rule. Ordinarily, memories do not feel like they're present, but in certain special cases like trauma, they feel like they are, like it's actually happening. So that would be an interesting place to investigate, but you know, we're able, fortunately, to investigate without having to go through trauma. So we have plenty to look at in our own experience. Okay, let's look, let's stop there. I'm going to see whether I can actually figure out how to save the chat. I guess I can probably just copy it. And this is something that normally Kathleen would do. So, because, you know, people had great things to say. And I want to make sure that we preserve them. So I think I can do that here. I'm just stalling a little while I double check to make sure that happened. One moment. Yes, we've got it. Okay, so great. We're done for today. I will say some things in the write-up for next week about this previous chapter. I'll try to confine it to the things that seem most salient, most important. But thank you very much, everybody. Nice way to start the session.